Today's show is sponsored by Miracle Made. And oh my God, you guys, you know that I love a luxurious set of sheets. And I now have such a set of sheets because of a Miracle Made. They are bedding that has been inspired by NASA. They've got silver-infused fabrics that actually make temperature regulating a thing. So you're not like getting too hot or too cold or whatever, you know, the whole thing that happens with your body's temperature losing its mind. Miracle Made helps with that. One of the little things that my husband particularly loves about Miracle Made is that it like doesn't have as much bacteria as regular sheets because of it's infused with this silver that prevents up to 99.7% of bacterial growth. So it leaves the sheets cleaner for longer. And then the thing for my husband is that it doesn't give him acne, which is like an issue for some people. But more than all of that, it's just luxuriously comfortable and delightful. And it has that cooling feeling while also being cozy. Very hard to achieve those two things at the same time. I mean, Miracle Made, come on, well done. So here's what I think you should do. I think you should go to trymiracle.com/fakethenation and buy some sheets today. And if you order today, you can save 40% off. Use the promo code FAKETHENATION at the checkout and you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. So there's just a lot of savings here, folks. Order today, you'll get 40% off. Use the promo code FAKETHENATION. Go to trymiracle.com/FAKETHENATION. And Miracle's so confident in their product, it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you're not 100% satisfied, which I don't see happening, you'll get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/fakethenation and use the code FAKETHENATION to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/fakethenation to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode.
Fake the Nation, episode 222.
Hello, hello, and welcome to Fake the Nation, where we talk about news, we talk about politics, and where we take the stale bread that is America, we dip it in the light egg wash of democracy, encrust it with pecans and cinnamon and a dash of mail-in ballots, and fry it up till it turns into a French toast that is fit for a queen, or rather, some sort of head of state that is not monarchical. I am your host, Nagin Farsad, and I feel that frisson of excitement in the air, a little bit of fear, but mostly excitement because, motherfuckers, we're doing it, right? The elections are happening. People in parts of the country are voting. They're voting. It has already started. Ballots are out. People are sharpening their ballpoint pens. Democracy is in action. It's so exciting. And today we're going to talk about the elections. We'll also talk about the confirmation hearings in which Amy Coney Barrett is perfectly open and transparent about her views. And the SATs. Are they one of education's great failures? Or should I be asking a less clickbaity question? Okay, folks, I'm so excited by this panel. This is a really great panel. We have joining us as he's done before many times, an alum of the show, a beloved alum of the show. He's done so much radio and podcasting that I've enjoyed over the years. He is host of This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. Folks, it's Jody Avergan. Hey, Jody.
Hey there. Are we expected to do all of our metaphors as brunch metaphors throughout the rest of the show?
Yes, that is an expectation. I hope you saw that in the email. Okay.
Pancakes, French toast, etc. Okay.
Yeah. And this next gentleman has been with us on the show before. We love him so much. I've enjoyed seeing him do live performances in New York City. And you can actually now see him do several 90-minute stand-up live stream shows. He does them on Zoom every week, and most shows are just a dollar. And you can actually find information about those shows at judahfriedlander.com and on Twitter and on Instagram at Judah World Champ. Because, folks, it's Judah Friedlander. Hey, Judah.
Hello. It is a pleasure. Thank you.
And I actually don't want to forget to mention that you have a special on Netflix called America is the Greatest Country in the United States. It's one of my favorite specials on Netflix. So people should absolutely be watching and rewatching that, as I have done. Folks, topic number one. Amy Coney Barrett is enduring a Senate confirmation this week as we tape. She's on day three of Admit You've Ever Had an Opinion 2020. So let's just start with a softball, as most of my questions are. What do you think of her? How's she doing?
I honestly have not much of an opinion and don't really spend too much time thinking about her. I think about how we got to this moment, which we'll talk about. And that's where sort of my mental energy is. But as she is what you would expect. I mean, she is saying all the things that you would expect. She is filling a slot that you would expect Trump and the Republicans to push through, I think she's, we can get into some of the specifics of how she's evaded and given answers to some questions and not to others, but as a performance, it is pretty standard. It's kind of amazing to say that the first 3 days of the hearings have been the most normal thing in all of the things around her nomination, but they kind of have. They're sort of pro forma.
Judah, what do you think?
Well, I've just been appreciating the diversity that fascism is bringing. women aren't always brought into the.
Yes.
Installing of fascism, and it's a beautiful thing to see. It really is.
We can talk about. Well, let's talk about this person as just an interesting kind of Christian icon, because, and then we'll talk about how we got to this point. But I think she's such an interesting person. She's the mother of seven. She's adopted a couple of those kids. She's just sort of an outstanding citizen and professor and neighbor and all of those things, right? She's very religious. And it's interesting because I think there's this line of argumentation that there may be a problem with her Catholicism, although I think that's really hilarious because Joe Biden is also Catholic, so I don't really understand where that's coming from. But I think that's great. She's a pillar of the community. That seems great. But what's also interesting about her, and we sort of saw this in one of the pieces in the Times, is that she's not it's interesting that she's this Christian woman that's being nominated for the Supreme Court. Not many Christian women actually end up achieving what she has achieved, evangelicals and whatnot at that level. And I thought I think that's really interesting that she has, and that maybe we could see more from women. From evangelical Christian women. Sorry, I'm looking for. Oh, yeah. We read a piece by Caitlin Beattie called Why Only Coney Barrett Gets to Have It All. And, this writer had done a bunch of research, had researched 125 women over 2 years about what they, about their role as women in the family and Christians and God's design. And they kind of all talked about that being a mother and a wife was generally at odds with having career ambitions at this level. So I think that's really interesting about her.
I mean, I think that biography is very compelling. And I think that, she, as all public figures can potentially serve as models for others. But I also am a little wary of thinking of her as a sort of type or a trope. I think of her as very exceptional. And moreover, her appearance at this moment is the result of a very concerted project, right? Over the course of decades and then more recently over the course of months to position someone like her in this position to fill a very specific seat. And so I don't think, there's a large project to open up what Christian women are capable of. Very specific project to fill one specific seat on the Supreme Court and get power and position someone like her and groom someone like her. I don't say that dismissively, groom someone like her to be in a position to take that seat.
And yeah. Really, I mean, I don't mean to make it sound like it is a new era of we're going to see a bunch of women. That is what's really really kind of shocking about the whole thing is that she's such an exception in what this piece basically lays out as the rule, which is that generally you take motherhood and wifehood as your central duty, and those are at odds with career ambitions. And there's a bunch of quotes from pastors that are like, don't go to law school because why would someone want to be married to a lawyer? Like, there's literally stuff like that in the research that I find, you know, fascinating, upsetting. But let's talk about how we got here. I mean, Judah, you mentioned fascism. Do you feel like this seed is being stolen? And, you know, what are your thoughts on this whole process?
Well, I've said this before, you know, because initially, several years ago, Justice Scalia passed away, and the previous administration was going to put in Merrick Garland. That got blocked. And then two other seats were filled, and now this one. I think they should have just kept Scalia. I don't think they should have let death get in the way of his ability to interpret the Constitution. You know, they have those big puffy robes. It could have just sat him up there. You know, a new vote comes in. Maybe, you know, should gay marriage stay legal, you know?
Yeah.
And then Sotomayor could, like, you know, put her arm behind his back and be like, yep, he'll give a yes on that. So, but, you know, it's...
A weekend at Bernie's SCOTUS edition.
Basically, yeah. You know, it's... I think this... A couple really scary things, happened yesterday when she was asked flat out, you know, can a president delay an election? Can the president expects the Supreme Court to, basically decide the election for him? And, you know, she dodged both those questions.
Yeah.
Things aren't legal. Dodging. The president's not allowed to do that. And she wouldn't answer that. So I think it's, I think the country's at a terrifying point in its history right now.
Can I say, though, Judah, one thing about the country being a terrifying point? I am a little less terrified by this particular point because I think we already got here with the nomination and confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh. You know, we already had a conservative majority. So I sort of, I mean, yes, in terms of the election vote, it is worse, blah, blah, blah. But like, but in terms of the long-term effects of a Supreme Court, we already had a conservative majority. So we were already sort of living in that.
Yeah.
But this pushes the center, so to speak, of the court so far to the right. I mean, you have to keep it in the context of Merrick Garland.
Sure.
Not
yeah.
Just
yeah. I mean, no, I totally
Kavanaugh,
get it. Yeah. Like, yeah. I join everyone in their terror. But like, but I think my terror just sort of already started. I think maybe I've just been living with the terror for how long has Brett Kavanaugh been? 45 years? I don't know. It feels like forever ago. the other thing that I thought was really, let's just talk about originalism for a second. Mm-hmm. She says that, quote, in English, that means that I interpret the Constitution as a law and that I interpret its text as text and I understand it to have the meaning that it had at the time people ratified it. So that meaning doesn't change over time and it's not up to me to update it or infuse my own policy views into it. And then, you know, she was asked about, does she own a gun and stuff like that and her views on guns. And it's weird to be an originalist and be asked a question about a gun because at the time it was about muskets, right? And right. So she's just as a person able to obviously as a person, it's not like she's fucking churning butter. She's already moved beyond the time the Constitution was ratified. So I just think originalism is one of those just super odd things that you have to compartmentalize so deeply to make that work. Thoughts on originalism?
I mean, not only that, but also I think that what we're seeing, this week, and I think in general we see around originalist arguments is often it's originalism around a very particular part of the Constitution. And you rarely hear originalists talk about the amendments to the Constitution that expanded rights and that pushed in a progressive direction. You know, those were written into the Constitution. Those are part of the text. But, you know, right. usually when you hear people cloak themselves in originalism, it's about, you know, the words that were consecrated right off the bat, as opposed to the fact that it has expanded and the Constitution is the Constitution now. And it has all sorts of other kind of more expansive rights written into it.
Yeah, like the word slavery just full kind of essentially rips to shred the idea that originalism makes sense at all, you know? Because it's a slippery slope. So which amendments are you into? Which, how many years after the original do you go beyond? Like, it just seems crazy to me. Judah?
Yeah, well, I think they're being quite honest with what they mean. You know, they want, you know, our government has had minority rule. That's pretty much been the standard. You know, it's land-owning, wealthy white men who wrote the laws initially, slave-owning men who wrote the laws. That's who wrote the Constitution. Those are the founding fathers. They're slave owners. And if you look at our current country, you know, it's a... You know, like people talk about, Trump. Oh, they're going to get him. New York's the attorney general. They're going to get him after the election. It's like he's been a criminal his whole life. They haven't really gotten him. You know, so the laws are written by, you know, the powerful few to protect them at the detriment to everyone else. So these originalists, I think they're being quite honest in what they want. They don't want anyone besides them to have any power, to have any rights. You know, that they one of the Republican elected officials, I forget who it was, just the other day said, "We're not a democracy. We're a republic," saying that democracy is not something that they even want. You know, they're being, you know, they're being right. They're flaunting a little more than they normally do.
Right. And I mean, to me, that is really the thing that's kind of, you know, like a real gut punch about the Coney Barrett hearings is that it does feel like in so many ways, just everything laid bare and everything out in the open about the kind of power grab that has defined the Trump era. And you have, you know, I don't even call what Lindsey Graham has done hypocrisy. I mean, I call what he's done as just kind of like bald-faced telling you that you should never believe anything he says ever again. That's not hypocrisy. And that he is perfectly willing to just do anything for the sake of power. And that, I think, is what this moment is really laying bare. I mean, you know, the Trump himself is really bad at not sort of showing his hand, right? He just says everything out loud. And Republicans have generally
terrible
been pretty good.
Terrible poker face.
Yeah, and Republicans have generally been pretty good about hiding it, right? Until this moment. And in this moment, they've had no choice but to basically say, yes, our project is to grab power. You know, I think there's a reasonable case to say our project is to consecrate minority rule. And this Supreme Court seat is absolutely part of that. And we will compromise a lot of other things that we've sort of valued over the years, or said we valued over the years, for that. And they've been forced in a very Trumpian way to just kind of like say the quiet part out loud.
Yes,
and
Judah?
The thing that scares me about that is that I think, now I could be wrong here, I'm not a prediction person, but I think it's likely that they know they're going to get away with stealing the election. And, you know, I think they've done it before. This wouldn't be the first time, you know. So I think that's, I mean, it's hard to say what it is. You know, do they know they're on their last legs? And so they're just going all out now and they don't care about hiding it. Or do they know they're going to get it? You know, I don't know.
Well,
what do you think?
I think that it's, that there's a... We'll talk about this in the next segment, but you know the polls are not showing very well for a lot of Republican Senate seats, and also obviously for Donnie. So this could just be like, fuck it, let's try and get this woman in, and then at least we'll have that, know. And I think
it's even slightly more insidious, which is, you know, Lindsey Graham, who really like.
He's in a tight race.
He's in a tight race. But I mean, I just, I don't know. I can't, I just, Lindsey Graham has just, I just can't think about the man right now, given what he's done, you know, in this situation. But, you know, I think he, if he loses, he will, a year from now, 2 years from now, tell himself a story that it was worth it. And not only was it worth it, but that he was principled because he was able to get the Coney Barrett on the Supreme Court.
Right, he will justify
to himself. Yeah. I think there's a little, I don't like to do a ton of pop psychology, but I think there's a little bit of that going on with Republican electeds. This is their last chance to kind of give themselves something that will give themselves a story to tell themselves about what they did during the Trump years in a couple years, even if they get wiped off the electoral map, which could very well happen.
By the way, people ask me a lot, like, what does this mean? Like, can the Democrats do anything? And actually, they can't really. They can delay the vote, I think, by about 1 week. But that won't take it till after the election. We would really need some Republicans to come on board with delaying the vote.
I think they should still delay. I think they should pull out every trick. Anything they can.
But Judah, what do you make of the argument that they should let this go forward because at this point the best way to hold Republicans accountable is in the election, and if you just get Democrats as mad as possible and up in arms as possible, you have the chance of harder pushback.
You know, I mean, we'll know in a few weeks or a few months, depending on how it goes. You know, if that strategy will work, I don't know. You know, I'm not a strategy prediction person. I could see it working. I can see it failing. And so I just don't
know. And we're also so scarred by 2016 that no one can tell anything anymore ever. And we're also so scarred by like fucking Facebook and Twitter and just the rhetoric and presidential nominees yelling at each other on television. And I mean, we're scarred. You know, rallies where a chant is lock her up, or Nazis proud being supported at the highest levels. I mean, there's so many things that have left us scarred. So I don't think no one wants to make a prediction because our predictions have been real shit in the past.
You know, I think the result in 2016 didn't surprise me. I didn't, you know, I thought Trump had a very good chance of winning. And when it comes to this election, you know, the Republicans only need to do enough cheating, stealing, and voter suppression in a few states. I think a lot of people don't realize. They don't have to cheat in every state. They can cheat enough in five states.
Focus their cheating. Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
If it's
more
close in Michigan,
cheating.
If it's close in Florida, if it's close in Texas, Ohio, wherever, they do enough cheating where they can do it. You know, unless there's a blowout, I think then they're going to have trouble, you know, stealing it. So, anyways, I don't know.
On that uplifting note, let's take a quick break and hear about our sponsors. And when we come back, we'll get into other discussions. Today's show is sponsored by Prose. This is kind of, I feel like, you know, I'm on some sort of Lord of the Rings journey trying to figure out skincare. And I feel like this customized skincare line is really got my name on it. Basically, every bottle of Prose custom hair care and skincare, I tried the skincare just recently, is made to order and it's personalized. It's got a unique blend of naturally powerful and proven effective ingredients to meet your needs, like specifically you. And then the way they do it is you take this great, like in-depth quiz, basically. They analyze over 80 factors for a complete view of your life, your beauty goals. Like I have oily skin that's also dry, which is just a fun little conundrum. I live in New York City. Like we've got these four seasons. My face gets weird during seasonal shifts. All of these things I got to kind of talk about in answering the questions. The other fun thing was they asked us at the end, like, do you like a creamy type of moisturizer or like a less creamy kind? And I was kind of like, I think like less creamy. And they were like, that's fine. Like you can do that. But we think for your skin type, creamier is better. And I never knew that. So I love that there's so much kind of
personal information that goes into creating this. I got my stuff in the mail very quickly after. I got a wonderful serum. Like I said, this very creamy moisturizer. And this also very just delectably creamy cleanser that just kind of feel like I think it's possible that I've been washing my face with just like harshness for like many years. Because when I saw this cleanser, I was like, oh, is this what it's supposed to feel like? It's supposed to feel like a little bit of a delight on my face. That's not what I've been doing. So I don't know, guys. And here's the thing. You don't have to take my word for it. In a third party, double blind dermatologist supervised controlled clinical study, which is like the gold standard for research studies, pros prove that personalization works better than off-the-shelf alternatives, which just sort of totally makes sense on a just logical level. If you think about it, just it makes common sense. Pros are so confident that you'll love your results that they're offering my listeners an exclusive trial offer so you can see the difference custom care can make. 50% of your first subscription order at pros.com/FakeTheNation will be taken off. That's pros.com/FakeTheNation. You get your free consultation and 50% off your one-of-a-kind formulas. Again, that's pros.com/FakeTheNation. Go and get your just super personalized, luxurious skincare products and hair care products. That's what I'm going to try next. So pros.com/FakeTheNation. I am the type of person that has subscribed to things and I have forgotten about those things. I have paid twice for a children's educational app and I didn't know that I was paying twice for several months. Until that is, I discovered Rocket Money, and because I use Rocket Money, it just showed up all these things. The thing that I was paying twice for that made me incredibly angry, thank God Rocket Money ended that for me. It also cancels the subscription for you, so you don't have to like go through the hassle of going to that site and figuring out how to cancel. They actually make canceling very difficult. I don't know if any of you have had the experience, but I have been on a like a roundabout 8 exit nightmare trying to unsubscribe to something before. Rocket Money eliminates that hassle. It also alerts you to an increase in subscription price. And this is something Rocket Money did for me. It negotiates a lower price for something you already subscribed to. So like for my cable bill, it got me a lower price. And I was very happy about that. Nearly 75% of people have subscriptions that they've forgotten about, which makes me feel better because I'm one of them. But it makes me feel terrible because what are we doing? Losing that money. I don't want to waste that money. And I know you don't want to waste that money. If you struggle with these kinds of purchases, if you struggle with finances in general, Rocket Money will help you with the budgeting, help you track your expenses, help you, like I said, cancel those unwanted subscriptions. It's a personal finance app that finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending. It helps you lower your bills so you can get back to saving. I mean, me and my husband have been on the warpath, and Rocket Money has been a really big part of that. It has over 5 million users with over $500 million in canceled subscriptions. The average member has saved up to $740 a year using the app's features, which is, I mean, that tracks for me. So stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions. Go to rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Again, that's rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Save the money at rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. What are you waiting for? Folks, I feel like I've mentioned this before, but I tried other services that I was displeased with. And then a neighbor of mine was trying Factor. I had pulled them aside in the hallway and I was like, what are you feeling about this Factor? And they were like, it is delicious. You should definitely do it. So then me and my husband did it and we loved it.
They are chef-prepared meals that arrive to your door, and then in 2 minutes, you could be eating them. Like, it's so simple, and they're actually delicious. And for people like me who just sometimes, my schedule can be so maniacal between traveling in different cities and, you know, doing stand-up gigs. It's like I just don't have a typical schedule where I can plan, set aside time for cooking and all that stuff. So something like Factor really helps for me. The other thing that I love to do is try not to eat carbs. So they have a keto option, which is fantastic. It's super delicious. They use premium ingredients. You can get stuff with like filet mignon and shrimp and truffle butter and broccolini and asparagus, right? Like real ingredients. They're no fuss, no mess meals. They eliminate the hassle of having to prep. They're tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with flexibility. You can pause or reschedule. I've actually done that. I've both paused and rescheduled. Factor is basically your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. We're celebrating Earth Day all month long, and look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. So here's what I think you should do. I think you should head to factormeals.com/fakethenation50 and use the code fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code fakethenation50 at factormeals.com/fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. And we are ready for topic number two. So Donnie tweets that New York and Illinois are going to hell. He says no more stimulus negotiation. And then he says yes to that negotiation. He withdraws from debates where he would have had the chance to speak in front of millions, which he may not realize is more than the number of people who go to his rallies. And through it all, he's a rather unpleasant person. So my question is Donnie like pissing away this election?
He's a really bad politician. I mean, I don't think he really is. You know, I don't think there's anyone really out there who at this point can make any case that he's a sort of master manipulator or anything. I mean, he's a really bad politician. He can't stay focused on a particular issue. He can't sort of take advantage, as you said, of an advantage. You know, and I think that one of the lessons of 2016 that we're realizing in retrospect was just how powerful running against Hillary Clinton was for him and his base, and how much, you know, specific hatred of Clinton and misogyny in general was a huge element in that election. So that for all the bad politicianing he was doing, it still kept popping up as a salient issue, and he was still able to ride that wave. And he just doesn't have that now. And so, you know,
well,
and
he also
has a 4-year track record, which, you know, I mean, I'm a believer that we knew everything we needed to know about Donald Trump in 2016. But nevertheless, I will also acknowledge that he has been president for 4 years and it has not gone that well either.
Right. So, and I also want to point out that he's really tried to bring Hillary Clinton back as the nemesis, even though he's not running against Hillary Clinton, by getting Bill Barr to release her emails, which he's agreed to. So, which I think is sort of, I don't know how it's played out in conservative media, but it's sort of been just a blip in mainstream media because nobody cares about what a suburban woman in, you know, what's the name? Chappaqua. What some random suburban woman in Chappaqua is doing. You know what I mean? Like, it shouldn't be of national concern, and it is, in fact, not of national concern. Judah, what do you think?
I don't want to lose track of what the original question was. I'm sort of annoyed.
Let me actually read to you this little passage. Rich Lowry, the conservative commentator and writer, he wrote, "If the existence of the country itself is on the ballot, why not prepare better for debates? Why not use Twitter exclusively for messages that advance his cause rather than detract from them? Why waste any time on petty animosities and distractions? Why not write down a healthcare plan and a COVID-19 plan to blunt Biden's most potent issues?" Rich Lowry is basically like, why is this guy pissing away the election? He's a conservative commentator. Judah, what do you think?
Oh, and he's saying that Trump is basically throwing it away.
Yeah.
Not
like,
being a
why
good
doesn't
politician.
He try at all?
Yeah. You know, that's a good point. You know, he's You know, he's probably, you know, even if you look at the pandemic, you know, instead of trying to ignore it and spending all this effort calling it a hoax and all that stuff, you know, and you know, the Republicans like to tout themselves as experts on the economy. If they actually would have focused on science and actually try to go with science, then there would be less spread of disease, and then the economy would be doing better. That actually right. would have taken less work than trying to ignore it and trying to get people to think it's not real. So, yeah. But I think that goes back to, you know, a lot of criminals and scam artists like Trump, they've never done things honestly and well. They mm-hmm. always look for the scam. They don't look for, oh, what's the straight up proper way to do this. They always look, all right, how can we rip people off? How can we deceive people? So I think that's one of the reasons where we are. So even when it comes up to coming up with a health plan, that's not what he does. He's a scam artist. He's not someone who makes things better for people. He's someone who scams them to make himself look good. So he's, you know, he keeps saying, oh, he's coming out with this great plan. He's got this great plan. He's been saying that for years. They don't have a plan, you know.
Right.
So, but I say to people, and I said this four or five years ago, do not underestimate the power, the unfortunate power of racism and sexism. And I think in 2016, you had both because, you know, Hillary winning, that goes on Obama's legacy. That's part of his legacy because they worked together and he endorsed her and campaigned for her. And, you know, Obama winning is probably, it's one of the main reasons Trump ran, I think. So, with Hillary, there was the sexism, there was the racism. And that stuff is still there. So don't underestimate that. There's a lot of people in the middle, you know, who just, oh, we just want to get back to normal, you know. I think there's a lot of people on the left and a lot of, you know, people who aren't white and people who aren't as high income who don't want to go back to normal. The normal was terrible. It already was terrible. It wasn't working. Too many people are oppressed. So if you look at the people on the right, the people on the right, the bigoted of the far right, and the racists and the white supremacists, they think that the white race, if there's a lot of people who think the white race is under attack, and that their whole power is under attack, that they're fighting for survival. You know, it's a completely evil and twisted, warped way to look at it, but I think that's how a fair amount of people, or more than maybe 40% of the people, are looking at it. So they're incredibly motivated. So, but I think there are so many people who are so scared and hateful of the current administration and how they're doing things that they are incredibly motivated too. But I have no idea what's going to happen with the election. I don't know.
Right. Well, you don't even have to be that motivated, like, to be so anti the administration. I think a lot of people are just tired of noise and they want to go back to when most people didn't talk about the president every day. Like, you know, because in my life before this, there were many days of a week where I would not mention Obama's name, like right in my own head or in conversation. Like it just, and no offense to Obama. It's just that he didn't fucking come up. You know what I mean?
But if you were part of a Tea Party Facebook group, you know,
then
you
he came up every day.
You know, I mean,
sure.
I think part of what we're both getting at is that, you know, the Republican Party, I think, has been a party that has structured itself over the last 20 years to run on grievance. And it's really hard to run on grievance when you are in power, right?
Right. Well, in the Bush, I mean, it's interesting though, because even in the Bush administration, and I was younger and shit then, but like, I still didn't. I was against that administration. I marched, right, in anti-war marches and stuff like that. But I still didn't talk about it.
No, yeah, for sure. You know, for sure. I mean, I think this is like next level. And there are people.
I think Tea Party wasn't under this much stress during Obama. You know what I mean? Yeah. I still don't. This is like next level shit that we've been experiencing. Judah, tell me what you, like you mentioned that the election could take months. I want to talk about election day / week / months. How do you think that's going to play out?
I mean, I have no idea because, you know, if it's close in some states, which it probably will be, the Republicans, I think, will never concede. They will contest everything. And I think many Democrats won't fight hard enough, as they've, in my opinion, they've shown in the past when, I mean, if you look at 2000 and how that turned out. So I can see this going on for months, you know, and, you know, when the majority of states are governed by Republicans, that's going to be hard to stop them from cheating, you know. And are the Democrats going to fight hard enough? I think in general, they don't fight as viciously and nastily as these far right Republicans do. So, and
well,
Republicans,
I mean, Biden now has like the largest legal team for this exact post election that has ever been assembled in the history of that kind of legal team.
Great,
that includes former solicitor generals and all this, like the fanciest fucking people. So, of course, and so I think there is an indication that they will fight hard, very, very hard.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, I think one of the, that's a great point you bring up. And I'm just thinking now, one of the things that might actually help the Democrats win is Republicans who don't like the current administration. You know, I mean, look at the Lincoln Project, you know, look at these other organizations that are right-wing organizations that are fighting, that are doing all the negative ads against Trump. You know, I've seen none or very little of that from the Democratic Party, but that's interesting. You know, that, you know, with the Republicans, teaming up with Democrats, the anti-Trump Republicans teaming up with Democrats. You know, that maybe that's going to be enough. You know, I don't know.
And independents, right? Because a lot of independents are like, this is garbage and like not at all fun, you know? And so some of those guys voted for fucking Jill Stein last time, you know? And maybe some of those guys voted for, who was that guy for the Libertarian Party?
Oh, Gary Johnson.
Gary Johnson.
Yeah.
Who was,
well, Gary,
like,
Johnson,
what's an Aleppo?
I think nationally, Gary Johnson got double the votes Jill Stein did. So if you look at 2016, I mean, you can check the facts. I might be wrong on this. But if you look at 2016, I mean, Gary Johnson probably took more votes away from Trump than Jill Stein did against Clinton. But with the left, it's interesting. And the left is, there's all different types of the left. And I'm not talking Democrats, I'm talking people who are leftists, and I think there's a fair amount who don't like Biden, but strategy wise, they would much rather fight against for what they want against a Biden administration than a Trump administration. That's something like Noam Chomsky's been talking about. Noam Chomsky's saying you have to vote out Trump. You can't, you know, don't fight against, it's much better to fight against, the current Democratic Party than authoritarians and fascists, you know. So, yeah. But yeah. there's still a lot on the left who, they're still upset at the Democratic Party. And it's almost like, I think some are being vindictive and are still not going to vote for Democrat. I think most probably will, but I think there's still a lot that
won't. Well, I have a few really, really hardcore Bernie bro friends.
Yeah.
And they have told me that they're going to vote for Biden.
Yeah,
and
this was
it's actually shocking because, and their tune changed from like literally January to now, right? The pandemic has changed their tune.
Right.
Like the economic crisis has changed their tune. Like they're like, oh, okay. I mean, I can be a principled Bernie bro, like until the, you know, cows come home, but like it doesn't make any sense for me to vote again, you know, to vote for someone other than Biden.
Well, I think Trump is so bad at this and so, you know, hated that I think that he will galvanize a lot of people on the left. But I think, you know, the other interesting thing that's emerging is, you know, you're both talking about the coalition that needs to get built and all the fighting that's going to happen around the margins. And I think there's the place where I think there's an interesting conversation and one that may actually have long-term effects is an understanding of that margin does not exist at 50%. That margin exists at 58%, right? For Democrats to win in this country and for this to be an election that is not in question, it needs to be, you know, 5 or 6 points the popular vote win by Biden. And I think like people are starting to really recognize that. And this may be one of those elections that really brings up some of those big structural issues for people. If it's within 5 points, I think we're going to end up in the shitstorm that you're describing. But if it's, but there's a chance that it's more than 5 points. And God, I'm going to rue these words, but like both, you know, Trump loses and it still galvanizes that big conversation of, wait, why did it take this much to win this election?
right.
And I think people need to start asking those questions. I think the Trump era is one in which people are asking those questions about the Electoral College, about campaign finance, about the Supreme Court. You know, these, we've talked about this on the show before, like these big structural things, people are starting to see the matrix a little bit. And, you know, I hope that that is the maybe the long-term silver lining from all of this.
Yeah, and I've been talking about, and it's interesting, yeah, I mean, obviously, I've been talking about the Electoral College since fucking 2016, and I've been, and also since I was in high school, and I was like, I don't understand why we would do it this way. Literally, I was like
a
child, and I was like, this is fucking ridiculous, guys. And then, but I've also been talking about the national voter, the national popular vote interstate contract, where states would agree to throw their electoral votes with a popular vote, and we've got a certain number of states. I mean, we can reach that 270 vote threshold through that compact. You know, there's mechanisms, right? That they don't all speak to the amending the Constitution, right?
Well, can I just add one thing there? I mean,
yes.
In 1970, Congress came within 5 votes. The Senate came within 5 votes of overturning the Electoral College. There have not always been 9 justices on the Supreme Court. You know, there were 8 a while ago. There have been more in the past. Like, these are just things that human beings get together and make up. And I think people are starting to realize that these are you know, these are that. And so maybe there's, we can start to ask those questions.
Yeah. It's sort of like we all decided to do VHS, but we could have done beta. You know what I mean? It wasn't a rational, it's just, we all just did that. You know what I mean? And so I think that's what we can do again. Like, let's just make a decision. Now, I want to say something very hopeful that I was reading about today, which is that there is a shitload of states. You know, this could take forever, and we should definitely be prepared for that. And I've been doing a lot of work for the Democratic position. I can't be more specific than that. I've been working on the elections, but then also one of the things we've learned about is that this notion that there's going to be some sort of civil unrest or whatever at election day and around that time is sort of seeping into the mainstream. And I just want to say, like, why is that seeping into the mainstream? Folks, let's snap out of it. Utah has been voting mail-in balloting, and it is a conservative state. They've been doing it since 2012. There's been nothing of note that has happened there. They've been doing it really calmly, and then they go skiing. You know what I mean? It's fine. Like, if it takes a little bit longer, it's fine. We've handled mail-in ballots. It's fine. Soldiers overseas have been doing mail-in ballots from forever ago, and it's been fine. So we know how to do mail-in ballots. There shouldn't be this, like, we shouldn't be sitting, like, waiting to just jump up and, I mean, you know, I don't think it's Democrats that want to do anything but peaceful marching. But I mean, there are people, obviously, violent opportunists, right? Who sometimes take those situations into another direction. But the other thing that I think is exciting is that is that, sorry, Florida, Arizona, are states where we could have early results because they have already been counting, right? They begin processing ballots 22 days before an election in Florida. In Arizona, the process starts 2 weeks before an election. In North Carolina, they start processing ballots on September 29th. In Texas's large counties, they start processing 12 days before. Georgia, which didn't make mail-in voting possible to all voters, did allow the processing of ballots to begin 2 weeks in advance, right? And we've seen long lines in Georgia, people voting early. Ohio started processing mail-in ballots last week. There's a ton of states that are actually, and red states that are actually processing votes. They're doing it early. I think you can steal elections, but it's very hard to coordinate out among 50 states to the stealing. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of people have to get on board. And I even think, and you hear someone like the Secretary of State of Ohio talk about running these elections, and he sounds just like a reasonable guy who has no interest, who is maybe also himself fucking tired of Trump. I don't know if he is or not, but like, we know Kasich is, right? So there's, like you said, with the help of Republicans, and keep in mind that Republicans are, that some of these types of Republicans are in charge of the election apparatus of some of these red states, who are just like, this is exhausting, you know? And that, I think, is so hopeful that we are able to process votes earlier than we've ever been doing. And also, I want to point out, I don't like talking about polls, but Biden is really up in the polls, and people are using the L word, which is landslide. Do either of you allow yourselves to let that word enter your head at all?
I mean, it's, I I'm not someone who predicts stuff. I can envision any scenario happening. I don't know what's going to happen. I can see it happening anyway. If the current regime is served a landslide defeat of them, that would be great. You know, I that would be the best outcome, because that would be a strong message that people don't like what they're doing. You know,
I mean, I tend to agree. I think you have to be honest about where we stand right now. Where we stand is Biden is up by a considerable amount, more than basically any challenger at this point. But, you know, 1 in 8, which is kind of where 538 has it right now. 1 in 8 is 1 in 8, you know?
Yeah, it's still a chance. Like, it's still a chance.
You know, like Kawhi Leonard misses a free throw 1 out of 8 times, right? Would you, like, set your hair on fire when that happens? No, like, those things happen. But that said, I think you also have to be, I think part of the, like, being wary of making predictions is also being honest about where things stand. And right now, Biden is up by a lot and is pushed past that margin that we've talked about, that 5.7-point buffer where the structural issues start to make it closer than it actually is. And if he can stay there, and that's where I think, Judah, like, you know, your point about some of the, the people call it stealing, some of the shenanigans that happen. I mean, those happen when it's close in 1 or 2 places. But if it's not close in 8 places, it's very hard to coordinate,
right,
whether organically or concertedly, to make that happen. And so I think, you know, liberals just have to hope that it's pushed past that margin for error. And there's no question in the way that you describe.
I think now is a good time for us to move into our next segment, which is a little mini segment between topics where I highlight races to watch. I started that in like a higher key than I normally do, so I couldn't fucking hit the note, guys. Jesus Christ. First, I want to just point out it's going to be Amazon Prime Day one of these days, but also fuck Amazon Prime Day. Everyone knows how I feel about Amazon. Do not fucking support that monopolistic motherfucker. Don't support it. All right, that was just a me. That's not a race to watch. Three League Green Legos on Twitter wants us to look at the Alaska Senate seat that's up for grabs. It's an interesting state because it's got more independent voters than any state. So Democrats Democrats have a real chance there with the candidate Al Gross. He's a doctor and a fisherman with money of his own to spend on the campaign as he tries to unseat Dan Sullivan. So look at that. So look at Al Gross in Alaska. Tara says for us to look at Adrian Perkins running for the Senate in Louisiana, vying to become the first Black senator to represent Louisiana since, wait for it, 1887. Holy shit. Matthew wants us to highlight Abigail Spanberger's race in Virginia's 7th district. And I want to point out something that's election-related, 1,000 Facets, which is a jewelry company that follows us here at Fake the Nation, is launching an election giveaway where 15 winners will be chosen and the prize will be a piece of handcrafted jewelry from an independent designer. Some really beautiful stuff if you look at their Instagram. For a chance to win, all the participants have to do is send a photo proving they voted by emailing it to atfvote@gmail.com. That's atfvote@gmail.com. Look, 1,000 Facets is trying to make democracy fun and bejeweled. So get into it. Let us now move on to topic number 3. So the SATs, The College Board and its main gig, the SATs, is in trouble for a variety of reasons that are all coming under scrutiny because about 1 million students have been trying to take the SATs, but the test has been canceled several times. And obviously because of the pandemic, they've been the hallmark of college applications. I guess my first question is, knowing what they mean in college applications, does the College Board have a responsibility to just shut it down? What do you guys think?
As a student was never a fan of the SATs.
Me neither.
Now I can't say, so I'm a little biased here, but I don't really know enough about the infrastructure and design of the SATs. I've certainly read many things about how they are biased and bigoted in certain ways. And if that's the case, and if it's still the case, maybe it should be like the police, abolish it. I don't know. It's SATs are definitely something I try to forget ever happened in my life. I don't remember what my score was. I know it wasn't horrendous, but I know it would not be anything that you would, braggingly say to anybody. What's that?
Did you hide it from people?
No. It just literally, I don't remember what I got. I know it was I think it was at a level where it's not something you couldn't brag about that score at all.
Right.
But it wasn't
you didn't have
low.
To be humiliated. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It wasn't so low that you were like, wow, I better not tell anybody this.
You don't remember it in either direction, right?
It was
unmemorable.
And I remember I had to take I got sent to a SAT prep class after school.
Yeah, me too.
And I still didn't, do that well on it.
That's where my head goes with these kinds of conversations is, I think I was told, and then I've certainly come to realize that, most of these standardized tests test your ability to take a test, right?
Yeah.
And so then the question becomes who has the resources, both who sort of lives within a structure and who has the specific resources to position themselves well to know how to take a test. And that's where a lot of the disparities come in and the structural inequalities and so forth come in. So, as a test itself, as a standardized, I'm not against standardized metrics, but, what are the systems that go into the performance of that is the real question. I mean, if we get rid of the SAT, that's not going to get rid of all the reasons that some students are not positioned to
do
well on standardized
tests. Right, it's not
going to
get rid of inequality.
Yeah, and so, I know this is sort of a cliche thing, but it's like, well, if you get rid of it, what are you going to replace it with? Well, chances are, if we just replace it with something else, it'll be something that still serves basically as a proxy for inequality. Mm. And so then we're left where we still are.
I mean, it would have to sort of be replaced with something that's free. I mean, that's thing number one, right? Like a thing that costs money immediately For sure. Disenfranchises certain people, right? Because they can't afford it. And of course, there's scholarships and a lot of people can take it for free and but like, you know, it by just that very first hurdle makes it difficult. Yes, Judah?
Question, do people have to pay to take the SAT?
Yeah.
Oh, that's terrible. You do. That's bad.
Yeah, you have to pay to take the SAT.
I didn't even know
But they do, they do make it free for people, you know, who can't afford it. But it I think, but again, it's like, it should just be free.
Yeah.
It should just be free. And then I think the other thing that's, you know, my relationship with the SATs is also very similar, Judah, because my SAT score, I'd say it was probably good, but I never shared it with anyone because it wasn't fantastic. And I was trying to go to Ivy League schools. I did, in fact, go to Ivy League schools. And I was a real fucking straight up nerd bomb who was also extremely overachieving and very ambitious academically. And so for me not to have a 1600 was just an embarrassment.
Wow.
And so I walked around with that pressure on my shoulders. And I think the SATs is a fucking mental game. Like if I had ashwagandha, you know, when I was in high school, maybe I could have just calmed the fuck down and taken a good test, right? It was like all the other tests I did fine at. That one test, you know, though, made me so crazy because I wanted so desperately to go to certain schools. And it felt like everything was riding on that test for me to go to those school, the schools of my dreams. And I was an immigrant kid and all I did was self-flagellate, right? And so I think in that sense, like the tests are ridiculous because I don't know, they're testing something about your ability to just stay calm during a test like that. I mean, and it's not, and then beyond that, there is the baked in bigotry of the test. And that, you know, the data that comes out of the College Board shows that Black and Brown students score lower on both the SAT and the AP exams, which they also run, than do white students. And it's not obviously because of any, you know, lack of intelligence. They always give the example of, what's that fucking sport that's like a Northeastern, like regatta and shit like that. There's like these things that are on the SATs that emphasize a sort of Northeastern liberal elite. And even like me in California wouldn't know what that was, you know? What's that? Lacrosse. Like I wouldn't know about that.
But what, like the questions are like, so-and-so starts Billy and Bobby get into their yachts at the same time.
Yeah.
But one of them, it's like that.
That's essentially, yeah, there's examples of that where the thing is such an elitist thing that like a kid, you know, in a from a lower income background or let's say an immigrant kid or whatever, wouldn't know what that is, you know? So they would maybe get the question wrong. So there's those elements baked in. I want to point out, though, the pandemic, again, has just like exacerbated their issue because now 500 colleges, including the Ivy League, have joined to a test optional movement. And a growing number of colleges are just becoming test blind. Like, we don't care if you have a test score or not. Do you think... And it sounds like they're doing that, obviously, without something replacing it. It's just like, now this is how we're doing it. Do you think this is a movement that's going to have legs after the pandemic?
I think it could. I remember, you know, my brother, he went to a college that I think did not look at the SATs because this was back in the 80s. And it was because they thought it was like, all right, that's kind of like what you're saying. Like, that's a test. There are some people who study just to take the test, you know, their whole education is to do well on that test. That doesn't mean they're getting a full rounded education. You know, it doesn't. Right. It's such a thing. You know, there's books about it, how to take the SATs and all. You know, it's a whole industry on how to score well at the SATs. That doesn't equal good education. That doesn't equal knowledge. That doesn't necessarily mean critical thinking. Yeah, I remember the school my brother looked at. This is in the 80s. I think they didn't, and it was like a good school, and they didn't look at the SATs. They looked at, you know, your full perspective Oeuvre. As a student and as a person. So I can see that happening.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect it will just require a little more work to get to know people in order to make those decisions. I think SAT scores are often used to just sort of like dismiss a whole group of people or take a whole group of people. I will say, though, I mean, I don't know if I fully believe what I'm about to say, but I will say that like a lot of life is like an artificial system that you have to learn how to navigate. And so an SAT test that is an artificial test that has its own rules and you have to learn how to take the test and it's testing your ability to take the test. Well, a lot of the real world is that way too. It's kind of like, for better or worse, you know, do you know how to play this game and have you figured out the secrets to how to play this game? So like, again, I'm not totally against the idea that like we should have artificial standardized things to, but it's just about who has access and who has the ability to get good at those things.
Right. And I mean, look, it doesn't mean that like the Regents tests, whatever, and I don't know exactly what I'm talking about, the New York Regents tests, whatever those are. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that those won't still exist. I mean, a lot of state level curriculum has these like tests. I mean, but they're free. So that's different. And they're part of like your public education. So that's also different.
You know, I'm starting to think we should have more standardized tests. I mean, look at both of you, both podcasters. You all took the podcasting exam before you got your shows.
I got a 1600 on the podcasting exam.
I failed the podcasting exam. That's why I don't have a podcast.
That's why you're only a stand-up comedian.
Yeah, that's why. I mean, I can be a guest. You know, I did well enough where I can be a guest, but I didn't do well enough where I can host my own show. So I think both of you are right. I think, you know, I think, Jody, that's a very interesting point you brought up about you know, everything is almost something you have to specifically prepare for. And right. And I think you can make that argument for school. I mean, I hated school. I looked at school like, you know, my attitude was like, I've been given a prison sentence, do behavior, try not to get it extended and then just get the fuck out. You know, that's how I looked at school. What I hated about school, at least with, you know, not all of it, but the majority of the schooling I had was how it just wanted you to memorize facts or what they say are facts, you know. So, you know, remember dates, remember this, remember that. I remember being in English class and you'd have to read a book and then you have to summarize what happened in the book. And then you would read some literary critics, what they thought about the book. And then you would write about what they thought about the book. They never asked what you thought about the book. So it's almost like they didn't want you to think. They didn't want you to think for yourselves. They just wanted you to remember shit. And to me, it seems like, I'm an old guy, so I don't know what the SATs are like now. But back then, it was just like memorizing a bunch of shit.
The SATs now are all just like regattas and lacrosse, just like the rules of tennis and golf. I also want to point out one thing that I didn't realize, which was that the first SAT was given in 1926, and it was designed by a Princeton psychologist named Carl Brigham, who was an avid supporter of eugenics, which I thought was a real sad point. But I also want to say that they also run the AP exams. And I took a shitload of AP exams when I was in high school, and I did very well on them. And so I walked into college with a whole bunch of college credits because I had taken so many AP exams. And so weirdly going, like if I had, like I would be like, no, but save the AP exams, which I know are still an elitist. There's also issues with the AP exam. Like I recognize that. But though I thought it was really fantastic that I got to walk into college with so many credits.
Did you say the SATs started in 1926?
Yeah, the first test was given in 1926.
And the Great Depression was just a few years later. So I think we can make the argument the SATs started the Great Depression, abolished the SATs.
I think that's clear. I think that's clear.
That's the kind of critical reasoning that the SAT is there to...
It's not encouraging. Exactly. Right,
exactly. Flawless critical thinking and theory there.
Yeah. Listeners, let me know what you guys think of the SATs. Should it just be shut down? Judah and Jody, Judah and Jody, Jody and Judah. That is the end of the show. My question to panelists at the end of these shows has been, what is making you feel hopeful? Because here at Fake the Nation, I don't know if you know, we're only doing optimism. We even have a t-shirt available, merch available at podswag.com/fake, a t-shirt that says we're only doing optimism. And people who have been volunteering to become poll workers and have been emailing about it are wearing their t-shirts to the polls. So, which makes me endlessly happy. So, what is making you hopeful and what is making you feel optimistic?
Well, I've been feeling a lot of optimism about my pessimism. and then sometimes people will yell at me saying, you shouldn't be a pessimist. That's not good. That doesn't lead anywhere. And then I'm like, well, now you're not being an optimist. You're the one. I'm optimistic about my pessimism.
Pessimism will lead somewhere.
That's a great question you bring up. Like, what is giving you hope? And, you know, I look at oppressed peoples throughout the planet, throughout history, and you look at how hard and how long people have fought, and it's easy to get pessimistic about that. And I often am. I probably mostly am. But you can also look at it in a way as, look at the fight in people. Look at how many people do want to get rid of the oppression and who do want to fight for it. And you look at the young people. The country is getting more and more diverse, which is fantastic. I don't know what's been taking so long, but it is. And I think young people are more politically aware every generation.
Yes.
And I think they're getting more progressive as well and more interested in human rights at a younger age. And that's so inspiring.
Amen.
Jody?
I mean, you know, I think my head goes to a lot of the same things that Judah was just talking about. I mean, I think that, look, what happens in the election will have a lot to say in terms of how we look at 2020, but I've become more and more convinced that 2020 is going to be a year that we look back on as a one of awakening and one in which people really, I think, got mobilized. And I think the big question is, what's the follow through to that? But I'm, you know, I'm optimistic and I'm let's see, I'm heartened by that and I'm inching towards optimism. but we'll see.
As a panelist on Fake the Nation, you're required to just be optimistic.
Okay, fair enough.
So what's giving me optimism and hope this week is, like, I saw a clip of people standing in line to do early voting in Georgia. And oh my God, these lines were so long. And they interviewed this woman who was holding a baby and an umbrella because it was raining. And she'd already been in line for a few hours. And they said, oh, I mean, are you going to leave because of the rain? And she's like, oh no, I'm not going to leave. I was like, leave because you're holding a baby. And it's like such a nightmare to deal with a baby in that situation. But no. She wasn't leaving. She was standing, you know, toughing it out. She probably had a bunch of squeezies, you know, in a compartment in the stroller that was going to make this whole thing work out. And she's my neighbor. And I mean that globally. Like, she's my American neighbor. She's on my block. She's in my community. These are people that want to see change, right? And they're out there standing in line for hours to make that change possible. They're doing it in the rain. They're doing it with a baby in their arms. How amazing are people, you guys? How amazing are American people? They're so fucking amazing. And that really gave this clip just said everything to me. But I would love for the people of Fake the Nation to know where to find you and all the good works that you do. Jody, where do they find you?
Well, my podcast, the podcast I'm doing now is from Radiotopia, and it's called This Day in Esoteric Political History. Three times a week, we take a interesting moment from our political past and talk about what it means for today. So you can find that wherever you get your podcasts. And I'm also on Twitter, Jody Avergan.
And Judah, where do they find you?
About 3-4 times a week, I'm doing my own stand-up shows where I do about a 90-minute set. It's interactive. You can see and hear me. I can see and hear you if you want, or you can watch it discreetly and have your camera off and have your mic off. So I do about 3 or 4 of those a week, and I announce them on Twitter and Instagram, which is Judah World Champ, JUDAH World Champ. And if you haven't seen my stand-up before, check out My stand-up film on Netflix, America is the Greatest Country in the United States. And I'll just say quickly, the shows that I'm doing are all new material. None of it is stuff that's been released before.
Ugh, I can't wait to join you in one of your Zoom shows, Judah. That sounds so fun. You know where to find me and all the stuff that I do. And my latest op-ed is out in the Progressive. And I was on last week's Don't Tell Me. So if you haven't listened to that episode, give it a nice download. And I don't know, I'm probably forgetting other things, but those are some things. But I would really would like to do is thank the production team here at Fake the Nation. That's our producer, Anita Flores, our talented audio engineer, Andy Christens, Gabby Alter wrote our theme music, Lily Fleshler helps with research. We love hearing from you, so send us your feedback, topics we should be chatting about, guest ideas you think would be good for the show. You can leave us a voicemail at 331-901-0005 or drop us a line at comments@fakethenation.com. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review at Fake the Nation. Please leave a review for Fake the Nation on Stitcher. Follow us on Spotify. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts. Leave us a review everywhere, and because it really helps people find the show. All right, folks, thank you so much, and we'll be back in your earballs next week.